Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. On the road, coming back to the city, and look forward to being there. Today, on Talkback, your opportunity to call in and share your comments and views, and we look forward to hearing from you. 888-874-4888 is our Talkback number. A little in-depth discussion about why are so many people ending up with heart disease. We're going to take a look at misconceptions about atherosclerosis, and William Falloon will share his insights. Fish, the latest on it and what you should know about it. Red meat, got some good stuff there that you're definitely going to want to know about. And breast cancer rates skyrocketing? Where? I'll tell you who's getting more breast cancer and how iodine can make a big difference. Also, five lifestyle recommendations to prevent aggressive cancer. Then in our commentary section today, from Steven Rosenfeld of Alternet, the stark realities of America's dysfunctional new economy, never discussed in the mainstream media or the talking head idiots on MSNBC and the other stations. We'll share it with you. Also, a letter from Rebecca Solnit, Prometheus Among the Cannibals, a letter to Edward Snowden from Tom's Dispatch. Also, the experiment is on us, science of animal testing thrown into doubt, and climate change creates a climate of fear. Reporter blows the whistle on Reuters news agency. The giant media's hostility to covering global warming extends all the way from the top editors to the low-level bureaucrats. A whistleblower talks. As you see, we have a lot to share. Plus, if time permits, 5 million farmers sue Monsanto. That's good. And what is the real cost of NAFTA? Before you trust anything this pathological, sociopathic-bounded administration has to say about anything, and I trust nothing, believe nothing, anyone in government says, because they're all just sociopaths. They don't give a damn about you. I don't care if it's the governor, the mayor, all of them. They need power. They crave power. They'll do anything for power. Well, why in the world would you assume that someone is that emotional dysfunction, so disconnected from all reality, would do anything to help you? They're not there to help you. And just look at how they help themselves. Well, I'm going to specifically focus on how they help themselves with NAFTA and now the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Dale Weinhoff from Common Dreams has something to talk about on that. Let's begin. A lot of people are using fish. Hopefully they're using oily fish like salmon or sardines. The smaller the fish, the healthier it is if you're a fish eater. The larger the fish, like tuna, the less healthy because it accumulates smaller fish, and that's heavy in mercury. You'd be hard put to find a healthy piece of tuna anywhere on the planet today. Now, these fish contain a type of fatty acid known as the N3 polyunsaturated fatty acids. Quote, fish habit may reduce breast cancer risk. Increasing the polyunsaturated fatty acid 3 intake has a protective effect for breast cancer, end quote. That's Dr. Lai from the Professor of Nutrition at Xinjiang University in China. They did 21 separate studies were reviewed in depth. Over 800,000 women in the United States and Europe and Asia were studied. And then they did follow-up. Their article was published in the peer-reviewed journal, the British Medical Journal. What they found is this. The more fatty fish you eat, the less breast cancer you have. The stronger your immune system, the healthier the chemicals in your brain, and the better regulation of your blood vessel activity. You have lower heart problems. Well, that's good news. So my hope is that people at least will focus when they eat fish upon the healthier varieties. But what's really in the fish? It's the fatty acids. Well, why not get purified fatty acids where the chemicals that would have been there in the fish are removed when you get them in capsule form. That is the highest standard of purified food from the fish that you can get. And you look to the manufacturer that guarantees that it has been purified and any form of toxins removed. Then when you take 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams a day, you're doing yourself a lot of good and you're helping prevent breast cancer. Everywhere we look, Americans are eating more and more meat. Not only are we eating more meat, but we're eating larger portions of meat, and that in part is because of all the misinformation and the myths and just the propagandizing of supersized meals in restaurants. Some of the most popular restaurants in America are those that give the largest sandwiches, hamburgers, steaks, pork chops, and that's not good. If you understand that your body can't store protein and therefore you only need what is about one forkful, let me say that again, about 2 ounces, which is one forkful, and that's all you need from the amino acids, from protein, from meat. So could you imagine going into a restaurant and someone brings you one single bite? That's it. One forkful, it's gone. And you say, why? Why would you give me so little meat? And then if they were smart, they would say, well, you get 28.35 grams to an ounce. And that's it's the grams of protein that you need. And you need about 9/10 of a gram per kilogram of body weight a day. For the average man, that's about 40 to 60 grams of protein. For a woman, it's between 40 to 50 grams of protein, unless they're pregnant, recovering from surgery, trauma, shock, lactating. Then they'll need some more. Okay, so if there's 28 grams to an ounce, and you just had 2 ounces, and assuming that anywhere from 40 to 50% is protein, which it's not actually that high, then that means that you're getting, because a lot of it's fat, and that means that you're getting more than enough protein for a given sitting in that 1-2 ounce portion. And that also means that there's no way of storing that protein. So then you have to go through a very specific process called deaminization of breaking that protein down. That causes urea and ammonium to build up in the blood. That can damage the kidneys, the nephron cells, the tubules in the kidneys, and it can damage the liver. That's the beginning of the problem. Now you go into a restaurant and they pride themselves on giving 16-ounce hamburgers, 32-ounce steaks. That means that you're eating an entire week's worth of protein at one meal. And we wonder why non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is an epidemic, 40% of the adult population. It's what we're eating. It's the sugars, it's the protein, and lots of it. This is from Reuters, quote, people who report eating the most red meat and processed meat before being diagnosed with colon cancer are more likely to die during the next 8 years. Quote, it's another important reason to follow the guidelines to limit the intake of red meat and processed meats. That's according to the Marjorie McCullough, the study's lead author from the American Cancer Society. Now, why the new study can't prove red meat or processed meat, such as beef or hot dogs or sausages, causes colon cancer deaths, previous studies have found that eating the meats is tied to an increased risk of developing cancer. So we have to understand how many people are going to get colon cancer this year in the United States. Around 145,000 Americans, 51,000 die this year from that. So we're not talking about a small incident. We're talking about a lot of people dying, a lot of people getting it. So just remember the hot dog, the hamburger, the salami on your pizza, that can cause colorectal cancer. Now, another thing that can cause breast cancer rates, and this is in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, a major cancer journal. Quote, in a finding that has researchers vexed, researchers are discovering that both female and male members of the U.S. Armed Forces are experiencing a rise in breast cancer. What's even more perplexing to researchers is the fact that historically, cancer rates among military members have been low compared to the remainder of the population, especially for lung, cervical, and colorectal cancers. That, however, is changing. More and more men and women in the military, quote, have been diagnosed with breast cancer at young ages, as female soldiers are 20 to 40% more likely to get cancers of the breast. Military people in general, and in some cases very specifically, are at a significant greater risk for contracting breast cancer. So said Dr. Richard Clapp, top cancer expert at Boston University. And this is what it is. Now, they're perplexed. All they're doing is reporting on it, but they don't know why. Well, let me explain some probable causes. First, because they're around depleted uranium. Their munitions they wear on their belt is depleted uranium. Now, let's see. The belt is around the area where it could impact and irradiate the pelvic region, including the ovaries, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer. And also they wear belts, including munition belts, depleted uranium, breast cancer. Also, they frequently are in vehicles that have depleted uranium shells in them, like tanks. They're also breathing in the air. It is ubiquitous. There's not an inch of land in Iraq and Afghanistan that has not been impacted by depleted uranium, because once a bullet or shell or bomb bursts, it microcrystallizes. It is small. Particulate matter has been measured. It was used in Afghanistan as far away as England and Germany. I personally interviewed the physician and the captain, medical doctor, who did the studies measuring depleted uranium in the air in those countries. It was coming from Iraq. So now the entire theater of operation has been completely contaminated. All right, how do you clean it up? You can't. It's not physically possible, because you're living in an extraordinarily arid area where the wind can carry a particulate matter for 1,000 miles in all directions. Also, when it does land, let's say, and when there are rains that come, or the wind puts it, embeds it into the soil or a tree, it's like a little tiny CAT scan machine just going off every millisecond for the next 4 billion years. When I filmed the documentary, multi-award-winning documentary, Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own, there was a physician at a hospital in Basra, in Iraq, and he said, we have over 5,000 photographs of deformed babies or children who were born but then died of rare cancers that we've never seen in this country before. Will you take these photos and get them to the American people? So the question then was, well, why haven't you given them to NBC, CBS, ABC, Harold Arruda, all the other, you know, all the other journalists who are embedded over there? And the answer is, we've tried. They won't touch this stuff because it shows the dark side of the American legacy of the war that's over here. So they simply don't tell the story with the assumption that the story doesn't exist. And as one doctor was very clear in saying, all we care about is the health of our infants and the mother. But now women are terrified of being pregnant, becoming pregnant in Iraq, because they've heard the stories and seen the results. Because remember, you're dealing with extended families. And we have not had a single news coverage anywhere in the United States on this issue. And you won't, because then you would have to take some moral responsibility for the thousands upon tens of thousands of deformed or dead children. So I put those at the end of the film. I showed slide after slide of Iraqi children alive and then their death date and what they died of. You saw children who had cyclops heads, one eye in the middle of the head, children born with no brain in their skull. These are not normal. These are not normal birth defects. This was due to the environmental contamination. And so that's Iraq today, and that's been Iraq. So just imagine, for 10 years, we have held solid, defending the corruption, the sociopathic nature of all the leaders, and that's all we have as leaders, sociopathic nutjobs. And not once has anyone taken responsibility for the human casualties and the birth defects because of our depleted uranium. Because if we did so, then we'd have to say, well, gee whiz, our own vets are there, and they're multiple tours of duty, and they're coming home and having defective children because their sperm has been defective or their ovaries are defective. Yes, that's true. Then we looked at the birth defect rates in GIs who had been in the theater of operations, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they are much, much higher than what you'll see in the normal American population. Whereas the vets who didn't go to Iraq or Afghanistan, who had children, they were normal. So this is a big issue, and no one's allowing it to be told. So I'm sharing it with you. Iodine is really good. Well, we know iodine can help people with their thyroid, and especially eating seaweed. This is the latest from Paul Fassa. Talks about women who were advised to have a double mastectomy performed in order to prevent breast cancer. We talked about this with Angelina Jolie. And I think that what she did was not just wrong, but because she's a role model and she's an opinion leader, that many other women will have their healthy, completely normal breasts removed because they had the so-called gene. Well, now there's new information that that instead of having multiple medical mutilations of your breast because of the supposed genetic predisposition, it's nonsense, try iodine. And it's done enormous good in helping people who have any form of predisposition. And that's what we're finding. The iodine used to be, the salt used to be iodized with elemental iodine to prevent goiter, but no more. So what little protection that was offered has vanished. So the RDA for iodine is 150 micrograms per day. But there was a Dr. Guy Abraham who initially mentored Dr. Brownstein, insists we should be taking much higher, like 10 milligrams of elemental iodine a day. That's 100 times greater than the RDA. It's also estimated that iodine per individual intake from seaweed and seafood among Japan's population is high, one of the highest in the world, and they have one of the lowest rates of thyroid, prostate, and breast cancer in the world. And some might argue that the Japanese, minus Fukushima, but historically get the iodine from food, but we're told iodine supplements are unsafe. Well, the FDA recommends 165 micrograms of iodine. And what about radiation sickness? What about getting x-rays? Speaking of thyroid cancer, there's been an upsurge of thyroid nodules leading to complete removal of thyroid glands to determine whether the nodules are cancerous. Some biopsy. Even if no cancer is detected, the person is sentenced to a lifetime of synthetic prescription thyroid hormones, and iodine can help prevent that unhealthy scenario. And here's just one look at this. Iodine has been determined to actually alter breast cancer-associated gene expressions. It turns off cancer-promoting genes and turns on genes that promote cancer cell apoptosis or cell destruction. And when you have programmed cell death, that's a good thing. Another study proves that large iodine intake does not adversely affect thyroid hormone production or quality. So we're going to continue to look into this. I'll look at all the world literature and show you that before you get your healthy breasts removed because of the fear, understand that there is work out there that's showing that iodine taken in the right amounts and taken under a holistic medical supervision could help alter that gene expression and save your breast. Now, we also know that eating right and exercise can help prostate cancer patients reduce risk of aggressive tumors. from Science Daily. Researchers at UCLA's Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center have published the first study on adherence to eight World Cancer Research Fund lifestyle recommendations in aggressive prostate cancer that shows a significant decreased risk of highly aggressive prostate cancer. So you just got to pay attention to the basics. If you exercise every day and eat a lot of raw food and you increase your servings of fruits and vegetables, it's showing you can reduce your risk of aggressive prostate cancer. And finally, some lifestyle recommendations to prevent aggressive cancer. And we need to do that. So what can we do? Okay, here's what we can do. First and foremost, be as lean and strong as possible. And without becoming underweight. There's a lot of evidence that the more weight you have on your body, the greater risk of cancers, bowel cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer. Make sure you exercise for 1 hour a day. That also can help lower your risk of breast cancer and colorectal cancer. Limit or eliminate completely foods high in fats and any sugars, and get more fibers into the diet. Time and again, we have seen now that foods like pizzas and fast foods and snacks and candy bars and biscuits, those all contain dense calories and little nutrition. So reverse it. Have something that has dense nutrients and little calories, like eating grapes or vegetables or sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, and get rid of the sugary drinks. Also eliminate red meats, beef, pork, and lamb. Avoid all processed foods. Why? Because lots of evidence that conventional red meat and processed meats cause bowel cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. And there is no amount of processed meat that can be shown not to increase that risk. All the weight is on the side of it causing cancer. Also, limit consumption of foods processed with table salt. There's a lot of evidence now that regular old table salt or salt-preserved foods cause stomach cancer and autoimmune disease. So try to use herbs and spices to give your food greater flavor. Lemon juice, lime juice, apple cider vinegar, all that will give you a salty flavor and a satisfying mouthfeel, but it won't cause cancer. It'll actually be good for you. So those are the lifestyle changes that can make a difference. I'm Gary Nall. We have a lot of calls going to come in now at 888-874-4888. But first, I want to do a few more of our in-depth analysis, and then you'll have more to think about to call in on. From our commentary section from Dale Weinhoff, Fruits of NAFTA, quote, drug cartels existed long before the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, in 1994, but not drug cartels as we know them today. As we approach the 20th anniversary of NAFTA, we can no longer ignore its contribution to building a powerful, violent criminal enterprise that has brought Mexican citizens close to being labeled as failed citizens in a failed state, and making the Mexican-U.S. border a war zone. Now, most often when we analyze trade agreements, the focus is on trade volumes and jobs and manufacturing statistics and poverty levels and immigration, all extremely important ways to understand the impact of neoliberal policies bequeathed to us from Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. But to fully appreciate how devastating free trade has been, we need to look more closely at the aftermath of free trade on the bonds that hold communities together. And it starts off small, a single thread that eventually leads to the unraveling of the whole cloth. Take the dumping of below cost of production corn from the United States into Mexico, which happened in full force following the passage of NAFTA. After a few years of not making any money on their small farms, Mexican peasants started moving off the land, leaving whole villages empty except for those too old to leave. This massive expansion of economic migrants was fueled by the lure of jobs and the new light manufacturing businesses on the border. operating in free trade zones. The supply of workers far outweighed the available jobs. These unemployed and displaced young Mexicans were vulnerable to the drug cartels, who recognized early on the opportunities created by NAFTA for the unregulated movement of goods across the border, including drugs and illicit cash. To fully appreciate how devastating free trade has been, we need to look more closely at the aftermath of free trade on the bonds that hold communities together. Life in this environment became very cheap. Piles of bodies started to appear in the border towns. Hundreds of young women started to disappear in towns like Tijuana and Juarez, and only occasionally showing up as bleached bones in the desert. Corruption and violence invades all aspects of life. The police, the judiciary, the financial institutions, the media, the businesses and elected representatives, the government, are all at risk and threatened. Now, nearly 20 years after NAFTA was passed, we read the story of the arrest of a crime boss driving his pickup on a country road carrying $2 million and walking around money as he goes to visit his family. If we are willing to follow this story back, we will meet thousands of Mexican peasants forced off their farms, and just as many young women sitting at sewing machines making running suits and baseball hats, all just a drop of a thread away from becoming foot soldiers in the drug trade. Their farm communities are still empty, devastated, and as often as not, under the control of the cartels. As we contemplate new and bigger free trade deals with innocuous names like Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, we should think carefully about the fruit of the NAFTA created and what free trade has done to destroy the bonds that hold communities together around the world. Just remember, Bill Clinton has never apologized for destroying millions of people's lives in Mexico, nor, for that matter, for all the people's lives he destroyed in the upsurge in corruption and massive poverty in Haiti, when the Haitians were able to not only create enough food for themselves, they actually exported some to other countries. And then after NAFTA, he dumped massive amounts of rice and potatoes and other crops there, cheaper than what the people could get them off the farms. As a result, the farms went broke because people wanted to get the cheaper food, and that was the American subsidized food. The media did not cover this, but that led to crime, and that led to suffering. And that led to the ghettos. Isn't it amazing? People can make $100 million from speeches, that's Clinton, but never once do we hear what is the true legacy that people with power create. Let's take a look at the real realities of America's dysfunctional new economy. Because I'm traveling, I'm filming, I'm seeing people. I'm talking with thousands of people about their lives. I just spent today talking with no less than 17 people for about 7 hours about what it's like to be them today. And there's a new normal in America with vast amounts of our society who are going through an enormously tough time. Despite all that we hear of happy days are here again, the economy's booming again. Look at Wall Street, new records again. Look at the profit of Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and Bank of America again. And then there's the reality of someone who I sit across from who cannot afford anything. So how is this happening and no one's paying attention? Well, it's simple. Let's look at some simple realities. First, it's not an economic recovery. According to Steven Rosenfeld from Alternet, not only is it not a new recovery, it's about getting away from the stock market and getting away from the home values and tech sector boom, all staples of mainstream media content, but it's not looking at the real world. For example, the woman age 30 and younger and Latino voters in the Orlando area and working class men and women of all ages near Columbus, Ohio, said in many different ways that their personal finances were frail. One was, quote, afraid of losing her house. Another said, back 6 years ago, I was making double the income I'm making now. Another said, I think the best way to describe my finances is precarious. Another said, "Me personally, not so good. My household is getting by. I own my own home and don't see the home values going up. I see the neighborhood selling quickly, but what are they selling for? Two steps forward, four steps back." Also, let us be realistic. In the real America, outside of Manhattan and Los Angeles, you have the mood is fear, not hope. Many people today are living at the economic edge, and or they've tipped over it. So you speak with them, you're going to get a different perception. Also, self-sacrifice is now routine. And here's what we have to understand. People have tried to cut every corner they can. They're pulling resources and not just having underemployed young people move in with their parents, but people taking in their parents after their jobs disappeared. Quote, cutting back on unnecessary items and home and just living paycheck to paycheck was how one participant put it. Quote, looking for sales, pinching pennies. I moved my mom in with me last month. I'm currently supporting my mom. Her factory shut down and she was on unemployment. After we pay our bills, we make sure that our children eat, but there's times my husband and I cannot afford even food. We eat peanut butter, potatoes, and rice. We make sure our children are eating four food groups a day. Then you have the reality of when people look at Washington, what do you see? When I look at Washington, I see one gigantic septic system filled and overflowing with smiling faces swimming around in it. Those are politicians. And we all know this is the truth. We know these people are sociopathic. They're mentally disturbed. We know they're greedy. They're selfish. They'll lie about anything. We know they're only self-interested. They've sold their souls, with a few exceptions, to the lobbyists, to special firms. We know the lobbyists are there. These are the human parasites. These are people in the real world could not function unless they're associated with something that continues to remind them that somehow they still need to do better, own more, spend more, control more. So again, they use their former positions, governmental agencies, and bureaucracies to their advantage. So what happens is one day we wake up and we just have lower and lower expectations. Tellingly, when asked what a good economy would look like, the responses were a litany of humble aspirations. Paying bills on time. Just having a few extra dollars in your pocket. Having a full-time job. Being able just to go out, maybe to a movie or have dinner. This now is the average expectation. And this is in stark contrast to what we had for about 40 years when people did have a living wage and there were more unions and there was better representation and there were more small businesses. And then there is the biggest of all. There's no escape from debt or loans. Now, at what level of common sense do we finally have to just stop and just say, hey, you bailed out the banks that were corrupt. You didn't put the too big to prosecute in jail for running drug cartel and terrorist money and washing it, money laundering, $800 billion. And you bail out the people who were committing illegal acts by getting liar's loan and fraudulently overappraising the value of houses to get higher amounts. And you bailed out the pharmaceutical industries and the hedge funds and the equity partnerships, and you took away the Glass-Steagall Act, and you let them trading commodities essential to life like oil and water and food and buy up land on speculation and currency exchange. You allow them to do all this, and you forgave all their debt. And yet when we need help, when we cannot bear the burden of our interest rates and compounding rates and late fee rates that can go 100%, you don't give us a dime. You don't help us. You keep us in debt as student loans, credit cards, home mortgages. And yet then you turn right around and you come right into our homes on television or right up to our and say, I'm for you. You're not for us. None of you for us. And especially the media, especially the alternative media. Because if you were, then you would show that we should go on general strike. Every student and every teacher should be on strike until they abolish all interest on student debt, so the students don't carry any debt, allow them to declare bankruptcy, and also start forgiving debt. If you can forgive $20 trillion in corporate debt, why can't you forgive $1 trillion in student debt? And why can't you forgive $1 trillion in credit card debt? You could, you choose not to. So that's why people are stressed. Older people said that new college and university graduates face untenable pressure. Quote, when you come out of school, you're a $50,000 or $100,000 in debt. You're lucky if you're making anything like $30,000 a year. That's paying your bills. That's paying your rent. You're not paying off your debts, so you'll never get ahead. There's lots of students that just graduated and can't get a job. And some parents said that they don't even know how they could afford to pay for higher education. Shouldn't we have state universities with free tuition? We could, but we choose not to. And then, of course, almost as an afterthought, we realize that we have gross economic inequality. It's simply a fact of life. And that's not going to change because the people who have the inequality also have unlimited amounts of debt that they can borrow at zero interest. And they're so clever at it. They can go to the Federal Reserve window and borrow $100 million at zero interest, turn around and invest that in currencies or sovereign bonds and make 2 to 6% interest. So they just made 600% profit or cost them nothing. You and I can't do that. We're given no preferential treatment. But then for those of you who've worshipped at the altar of big government, and shame on you for doing that, you thought you were patriotic. No, you were just dumb. Because here's how it works. Every government, from the local community government to the state government to the federal government, should be there for one thing only, to serve the legitimate interest of protecting the people, protecting its environment, holding in common those things we all need. We need a fire department. We need a police department. We need city parks. We need clean rivers, clean lakes, clean water. We need a safe environment to live in. We need factories that are safe to live in. We need to know that the products we're consuming are safe for us. We need to be protected, but not more than that. That would be one-tenth the size of government we now have. That means, 90% of what our government is doing, we do not need. Massive redundancy, massive bureaucracy. It's just one example. It was shown that 10 different departments have been created in one government agency to do the same identical work. So why don't you eliminate all but one? But bureaucracies become self-contained entities. They survive only for their own interests, and every year their budget expands, and we have to pay for it. We, who are never given a break, not our mortgages forgiven, so then they fear us, so then they take away our rights and they spy on us. They spy on us. They're afraid of us. So instead of saying, you have no right to spy on me, give us back our First Amendment, our Fourth Amendment, our Fifth Amendment. Instead, if you stand out, you're targeted. And all this in plain view now, because all the secrets are out. And yet we do nothing. No protest. Individual writers, individual activists will write commentaries that nobody reads. And nothing happens. And people go about watching, television, distracting themselves throughout their day, or living in gated communities, feel that, well, we've got our retirement funds and we live on this golf course, so we're protected. Are you? As long as you stay like a mole in a hole, which is your little, golf course community, I guess, okay, then you won't mind. But the reality is that the government now controls every aspect of our lives. The president just signed an executive order mandating that everyone has to take an HIV antibody test. So let me tell you the implication of that. Let's say that you don't have HIV, but you have measles, or you were pregnant, or maybe you had been to a country and you had malaria, or maybe you have hepatitis, or maybe you have herpes. All of those can give you a positive reading. And then immediately you're forced to go on antiviral drugs, which will kill you in time. And then suddenly it's very personal, where you're forced to have your kid vaccinated. Now they go door to door. If your kid hasn't been vaccinated, then they demand that you vaccinate them, and they actually have a person there to vaccinate them. Because the American public has become so passive, they just offer up their children, like with Gardasil, a completely dangerous and completely unsafe vaccine. And they can spend money on the military, the spying. They can spend it on big oil, big coal, but they can't spend it on we the people. They can't spend it on our bridges and our parks, our rivers, and our dams. They can't clean up the dams. They can't protect the soil. They can't reforest anything. They can't look at our infrastructure. They can't give us a 300-mile-an-hour train. They can't stop global warming. In effect, they can't do anything right. And yet you watch this. And I don't care about the right, because you can't talk with them in any case. But the left has always held itself up with such absolute complete conceit that somehow it knew all this. And then it turns out you knew nothing. Because the people who did know something, you held in disdain. Because they weren't your perfect ideological alignment. So you dismissed them. Well, they were right. The bankers were behind the problem. The military-industrial complex was behind the problem. The Bilderberg, the Council on Foreign Relations, were behind the problem. These were all people who contributed to our problem. So where's the demonstrations against them? Where's the demonstrations against corrupt government? Where's the demonstrations against lack of habeas corpus? Where's the demonstrations against anything? So that tells us a lot, not about the corruption of a government that's gone crazy and is just now overreaching at every area it can. Because the congressmen, the senators, your governors, your mayors, they now see that the public has no capacities for response. So they're taking advantage. And then along comes some grassroots people who realize how corrupt, utterly corrupt, the large major foundations and NGOs. I think they should all go straight to hell. I wouldn't give a nickel to any of them. And yet, especially in the environment, and yet the people begin to say this is wrong, what they're doing on grass hydrofracking or nuclear radiation or genetic engineering. And they, the people, are speaking up. And 2.5 million showed up in demonstrations spontaneously from grassroots and nothing else. It caught everyone by surprise. But what is 2.5 million in a country of 215 million? 99.9% didn't show up. That doesn't mean we shouldn't show up and we shouldn't write and we shouldn't vote for independent candidates that are populist. It just means that as long as you're on their grid, you're watching their programs, you're eating their food, you're shopping in their box stores, you're banking in their banks, you're voting for their politicians, you're listening to their music, you're following their celebrities, you're going attending their schools and taking their classes, then you and they are one. There is no 99 and one. It is all one. Because the 1% couldn't have the power if they weren't enabled by the indifference, the silence, or the active participation of the 99. And yet we are afraid to deal with this concept. So we like to keep it neat and even as a nice little platitude. Yeah, let's make it 1% are all bad and 99% are on the side of the angels. Unfortunately, that's not the case. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are some insights and comments of myself and others. And finally, we'll go to our phones after this. This is from Rebecca Solnit from Tom Dispatch. This is a letter to Edward Snowden. Prometheus among the cannibals. Billions of us, from prime ministers to hackers, are watching a live espionage movie in which you are the protagonist and perhaps the sacrifice. Your way forward is clear to no one, least of all, I'm sure, you. I fear for you. I think of you with a heavy heart. I imagine hiding like Anne Frank. I imagine Hollywood movie magic in which a young lookalike would swap places with you and let you flee to safety. If there is any safety in this world of extreme rendition and extrajudicial execution by the government that you and I were born under and that you and I, until recently, served. I fear you may pay, if not with your death, with your life, with a life that can have no conventional outcome anytime soon, if ever. Truth is coming, and it cannot be stopped, you told us, and they are trying to stop you instead. I'm moved by your choice of our future over yours, the world over yours, self. You know what few do nowadays, that the self is not the same as self-interest. You're someone who is smart enough, idealistic enough, bold enough to know that living with yourself in a system of utter corruption would destroy that self as an ideal, as something worth being. Doing what you've done, on the other hand, would give you a self you could live with, even if it gave you nowhere to live or no life, which is to say, you've become a hero. Pity the country that requires a hero, Bertolt Brecht once remarked, but pity the heroes too. They are the other homeless, the people who don't fit in. They're the ones who see the hardest work and do it, and pay the price we charge those who do what we cannot or won't. If the old stories were about heroes who saved us from others, modern heroes, Nelson Mandela, Cesar Chavez, Rachel Carson, Ella Baker, Martin Luther King, Aung San Suu Kyi, endeavor to save us from ourselves, from our own governments and systems of power. The rest of us so often sacrifice that self and those ideals to fit in, to be a part of a cannibal system, a system that eats souls and defiles truths and serves only power. Or we negotiate quietly to maintain an uneasy distance from it and then go about our own business. Though in my world, quite a few of us strike out our small blows against empire. You, young man, you were situated where you could run a dagger through the dragon's eye, and that dragon is wreathing in agony now. In that agony, it has lost its magic, an arrangement whereby it remains invisible while making the rest of us ever more naked to its glaring eye. Privacy is a kind of power as well as a right, one that public libertarians and librarians fought to protect against the Bush administration and the Patriot Act, and that online companies violate in every way that's profitable and expedient. Our lack of privacy, their monstrous privacy, even their invasion of our privacy must, by law, remain classified, is what you made invisible. The agony of a monster where nowhere to stand, you are accused of spying for the spies, of invading the privacy of their invasion of privacy. It is truly a curious thing. And it is changing the world. Europe and South America are in an uproar, and attempts to contain you and your damage are putting out fires with gasoline. You yourself said it so well on July 12th. A little over a month ago, I had family, a home in paradise, and I lived in great comfort. I also had the capacity, without any warrant, to search for, seize, and read your communications, anyone's communications at any time. That is the power to change people's fates. It is also a serious violation of the law. The Fourth and Fifth Amendments to the Constitution of my country, Article 12 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and numerous statutes, yes, and treaties, forbid such systems of massive pervasive surveillance. And while the U.S. Constitution marks this program as illegal, my government argues that secret court rulings, which the world is not permitted to see, somehow legitimize an illegal affair. These rulings simply corrupt the most basic notions of justice. That is, that it must be seen to be done, end quote. They say you, like Bradley Manning, gave secrets to their enemies. It's clear who those enemies are. You, me, and us. It was clear on September 12, 2001, that the Bush administration feared the American people more than Al-Qaeda. Not much has changed on that front since, and this almost an infinitely broad information harvest criminalizes all of us. The metadata, the patterns and connections of communication rather than their content is particularly useful, as my friend Chris Carlson pointed out, at mapping the clusters of communication behind popular movements, uprising, political organizing. In other words, those movements, while civil society rises to shape history to make a better future in the open world of the streets and squares. The goal of gathering all this metadata, Chris speculated, is to be able to identify where the hubs are, who the people are who sit at key points in networks, helping pass news and messages along, but especially who the people are who spread ideas and information from one network of people to the next, who help connect small networks to larger ones, and thus facilitate the unprecedented and rapid spread of dissent when it appears. Metadata can map the circulatory system of civil society. Towards what ends, you can certainly imagine. When governments fear the people, you can be sure they are not serving their people. This has always been the minefield of patriotism. Loyalty to our government often means hostility to our country and vice versa. Edward Snowden, loyalist to the country, you have made this clear as day. Those who demonize you, such as David Bromwich pointed out in a fine essay in the London Review of Books, their submission to the power you exposed, who stood where you, he writes, quote, was an infallible marker of the anti-authoritarian instinct against the authoritarian. What was distressing and impossible to predict was the evidence of the way the last few years have worn deep channels of authoritarian acceptance in the mind of the liberal establishment. Every public figure who is psychologically identified with the ways of power in America has condemned Snowden as a traitor or deplored his actions as merely those of a criminal, someone about whom the judgment he must be prosecuted obviates any further judgment and any need for thought. You said, I know the media likes to personalize political debates, and I know the government will demonize me. Who you are is fascinating to us, but what you exposed is what matters. It is upending the world. It is damaging Washington's relations with many Latin American and some European countries, with Russia and China as well, as its own people, those at least who bother to read or listen to the news and care about what they find there. Edward Snowden single-handedly forces tech companies to come forward with government data request stats, said a headline in Forbes. Your act is rearranging our world. How much no one yet knows. In conclusion, what's striking about your words on video, Edward Snowden? The ones I hear as your young, pale, thoughtful face speaks with clarity and incisiveness in response to Glenn Greenwald's questions, is that you're not talking much about what you hate, though it's clear that you hate the secret network you are part of. You hate it because it poisons what you love. You told us, I understand I will be made to suffer for my actions, but I will be satisfied if the Federation of Secret Law, unequal pardon, and irresistible execution of powers that rule the world that I love are revealed, even for an instant. You love our world, our country, not its government, clearly, but its old ideals and living idealists, its possibilities, its dreamers, and its dreams. Not the stale-stuffed American dream of individual affluence, but the other dreams of a better world for all of us, a better, principled way of living. You told us where we now live and that you refuse to live there anymore. Which is to say you acted from love, from all the things the new surveillance state imperils, privacy, democracy, accountability, decency, honor, the rest of us, what will we do for love? What is terrifying to the politicians at the top is that you may be our truest patriot at the moment. What makes all of them, with their marble buildings and illustrious titles, their security details and all their pomp, the flags, the saluting soldiers, so many traitors. The government is the enemy of the people. The state is the enemy of the country. I love that country too. I fear that state and this new information age as they spread and twine like a poison vine around everything and everyone. You help up. Why? Because you showed us a mirror and the fools hate the mirror for it. They shoot the messenger, but the message has been delivered. When the United States forced the airplane of Evo Morales, Bolivia's democratically elected head of state, to land in Austria, after compliant France, Spain, Portugal, and Italy denied him the right to travel through their airspace, all South America took it as an insult and a violation of Bolivia's sovereignty and international law. The allied president of Argentina, Kirchner, tracking the incident in a series of tweets that demonstrated an openness and principledness and a strong friendship between Morales, Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa, and her. It was a little window onto a really foreign continent, one in which the countries are sometimes headed by genuinely popular leaders who are genuinely transparent and governed by the rule of law. It's a reminder that things in our own blighted, corrupted, corporate-dominated country could be different. How did we get here? In 1996, President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore pushed the dreadful slogan, Building a Bridge to the 21st Century. It was a celebration of Silicon Valley-style technological innovation and corporate globalization, among other things. At the time, I put Building a Bridge to the 19th Century on my letterhead. It turned out that we were doing both at once, erecting a massive electronic infrastructure that outpaces our ability to democratically manage it, and shifting our economy backward to create the divide of class that marked the 19th century. The two goals intertwine like serpents making love. The new technologies made a surveillance state that much more powerful and far-reaching. The new technology replaced many jobs with few. The new technologies created new billionaires without principles. The new technology made us all into commodities to be sold to advertisers. The new technology turned our every move into something that could be tracked. The new technologies kept us distracted and busy. Meanwhile, almost everybody got poorer. What the neoliberals amassing mountains of wealth for the already super wealthy forgot, what the tax cutters, the child starvers never learned in school, is that desperate people do not necessarily simply lie down and obey. Often enough, they rebel. There's no one as dangerous as he or she who has nothing to lose. The 20th century's welfare states, their pumped up, plumped up middle classes, their relative egalitarianism and graduated tax plans pacified the once insurrectionary classes by meeting, at least in part, their needs and demands. The comfortable don't revolt much. Out of sheer greed, however, the wealthiest, most powerful, decided to make so much of us the rest of our lives suffer for their benefit. Edward Snowden, you rebelled because you were outraged. So many others are rebelling because their lives are impossible now. These days, when we revolt, the new technologies become our friends as well as our enemies. If you can imagine those technologies as the fire Prometheus stole from the gods, then it works both ways, for us and for them, to create and to destroy. Those new technologies are the key to the latest rounds of global organizing. From the World Trade Organization actions in 1999, put together by email, and in the apocalyptic impact to the Arab Spring, which used email, cell phones, Facebook, Twitter, and other means to occupy Wall Street. The technologies are double-edged. Populist networks are creating global resistance, are vulnerable to surveillance, classified reams of data are breachable by information saved to thumb drives or burned onto CDs by whistleblowers and hackers. They can spy in private, we can organize in public, and maybe the two actions are true opposites. I think of a man even younger than you, Edward Snowden, who, unlike you, acted without knowing what he did. 26-year-old Mohammed Bouazizi, who December of 2010 self-immolated to protest his humiliation and hopelessness, triggered what became the still blooming, still burning Arab Spring. Sometimes one person's changes can affect the whole world. This should make most of us hopeful and some fearful, because what I'm also saying is that we now live in a world of us and them, a binary world. It's not the old world of capitalism versus communism, but of the big versus the little, the oligarchy versus the democracy, the hierarchies versus the swarms, of corporations versus public interests and civil society. It seems nearly worldwide now, which is why revolts of all over the planet have been so common these days, why Occupy activists last month held up signs in New York City's Liberty Plaza in solidarity with the uprising in Taksim Square in Turkey, why Arab Spring activists phoned in pizza orders to the uprising in Wisconsin early 2011, why Occupy spread around the world and Greek insurrectionists learn from the successes of Argentina in the face of austerity and economic collapse. We know our fate is common and that we live it out together and change it together, only together. You and Prometheus stole their fire, and you know it. You said being called a traitor by Dick Cheney is the highest honor you can give an American, and more panicky talk we hear from people like him and Senator Dianne Feinstein and Congressman Peter King, the better off we are all. If they are taught a class on how to be kind, of Citizen Dick Cheney worries about, I would have finished high-end school. In conclusion, I fear for you, but your gift gives us hope and your courage an example. Our loyalty should be to our ideals because they are a threat to the secret system you've exposed, because we have to choose between the two. Right now, you embody that threat, just as you embody those ideals, for which I am grateful, for which everyone who is not embedded in the system should be grateful. End quote. Rebecca. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all very much for listening.
FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, listeners. I'm your host, Patricia.